the subject matter, the prayer in the garden. And, you know, these thoughts just came together in my mind when he walked in. Some years ago, expressing in his own words, and I know that Brother Bob uses a manuscript, all right? Or has many times. Excuse me for laughing, and I want you to understand that this is for illustrative purposes only. Brother Bob got so carried away with his extemporaneous comment about Jesus being upset with his followers falling asleep, that he said something like this, and Bob, I'm going to paraphrase what you said. Maybe quote it. No, I'll do it. He said, "What, couldn't you even stay awake for one lousy hour?" Those people from the Baltimore meeting remember that, don't you? Well, his point was well taken. His choice of words might have left something to be desired, but that's what I mean. That illustrates exactly what I mean. You will put your own personality, your own way of expressing into that thing, even though you may be tied to a manuscript. Now, reading the manuscript. Reading the manuscript. Now, this is where practice is necessary, but it can be done. It can be done. When you are the utilizer of a manuscript and you read it aloud over and over again, practice this point. Read ahead 3 to 5 to 7 words, and you would be surprised how that translates at least into a 50% eye contact situation, Harry. Absolutely does, even in that reading I gave you just a moment ago. The scriptural terminology sometimes is far more difficult than what we'll put down in a manuscript. If we pick up a manuscript and practice it, there's no reason in the world why we cannot effectively maintain 50 to 70% eye contact and still, in a nice, smooth, properly inflected term, read from that manuscript, almost to the point that your audience will not know that you are using a manuscript. And believe me, brethren, it can be done. It can be done. In public lectures, because there are certain things that I want to make sure I say just so, I will have manuscript inserts in my notes, full paragraphs sometimes, whereas I'm using the notes the rest of the time, Bob, but I'll come to that paragraph. And I know that I want my public lecture audience to hear that in just a way. So I will go from my extemporaneous 70 to 90% eye contact, drop it down to a 50 to 70% eye contact, deal with that paragraph, and hardly any of them ever know it. Because I work on it, and you can too. You can too. I don't know what this is. I just picked it up. I had it laying here, but it has something to do with evolution. The Vanishing Case for Evolution by Henry M. Morris. In spite of these admissions, all the scientists quoted above, I just looked at that phrase, and the words, all the scientists quoted above, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words, I looked ahead and was able to say to you with eye contact, it can be done. It can be done. Get your manuscript completed, go over it, and practice getting that head up and looking at something. If you got a wife, look her in the eye. If you got a mirror, look yourself in the eye. And you would be amazed, brethren, once you set your mind to it, you'd be amazed at how effective you become with it. If you are of the mindset that I've got to read by having my head down in that proposition, if that's the way you think, that's the way you're going to do it. What you have to do is think that I can read. That doesn't mean you bob your head up and down like this. I don't mean that. You get comfortable behind a stand at such a way where it's a matter of your eyes, not your head. Yes, Pete. All right. Whatever would enable you to do it is fine, just so your audience doesn't see you're doing it. That's right. That's right. And if you want to use a ruler or a piece of plastic or your finger, you can do it. I've got my hands on this paper. No, I don't believe any of you can see my hands here. I could actually move that finger very effectively, you know, spend 50 to 70% of my time looking at you, and I know where it is. That's the point you're making. OK? can be done. I've trained myself that I don't have to do that. But it can be done. And it can be done unobtrusively, so nobody sees it. Perfectly all right. Perfectly all right. Again, being redundant. When you use a manuscript, purposefully begin small and enlarge the use of signposts. The more signposts you use in a structured manuscript, the more your exhortation or lecture is going to sound like nobody is reading it. In other words, if you can enlarge the signpost propositions with just a little note, Bob, just a little note, you've told yourself the subject matter that you want to treat at that stage in your dissertation. And you'll find yourself extemporaneously speaking. And that, Pete, then brings you back. You see, you know where that signpost is. That brings you right back to your manuscript without a pointer or anything of that nature. But here again, it's a matter of practice, practice, practice. Now, let's talk for a few minutes about voice, pronunciation, grammar, and gestures. Voice is something that you have absolute control over. Whether you're extemporaneously speaking, impromptu, or from a manuscript, there's absolutely no excuse for any brother, whatever the pitch of his voice, to speak in a monotone. No excuse. You can purposely lower it, and you can raise it to the heights. You've got control over that. Just remember that. And when you read or emphasize, use it. Use your voice. Use your voice. And in the proper way of using that voice, there are several things that you must always guard. We've heard it a number of times this week. How is this word pronounced? That's a G. That's get. It's not get. That's just, not gist. Many of them, Gil. Many of them. Another error that we ought to be aware of, particularly when we use manuscripts, is the use of the words I and me. I do not intend to conduct an English class tonight, but one of the greatest errors, excuse me, made by brethren on the platform is to use the word I in the objective case, and it's absolutely wrong. And when you are giving a public lecture, you are condemning that lecture in large measure if there's somebody in that audience who knows you're making a mistake. I is the word that's used in the nominative sense, not the objective sense. When we talk about the way God treats you and I, we are making a mistake. Did you hear me? God treats you and me, not you and I. Now, when we talk about you and I doing something, that's correct. Brethren, that is the most common mistake made from our platforms worldwide, or at least North American-wide. I doubt if they do it as much in England. But it's a horrible habit in North America. May I repeat that again? You never use the word I in the objective sense, and you hear it all the time. I've heard it at least 24 times thus far this week, and it's wrong. Now, that's a small thing, but it's a very important thing. Another one falling into the same classification is the use of the word a and an, A-N. Articles. But you don't use the article A when the word A-N should be used. Repeatedly done. We will not do it, any of us, if we think about it. That's why I'm bringing it to your attention as speaking or potential speaking brethren. It's a technique in public speaking we ought to be aware of. You don't make those little mistakes, because when you do make those little mistakes, it detracts in major proportions from the effectiveness of what you're saying. Another thing that happens. Bless your heart, Chuck. Thank you. Another thing that happens, and it's common human, a common human trait, we tend to run our words together sometimes. We tend to sometimes mispronounce words by virtue of habit. Submarine for submarine. United States government for United States government. Boy and girl for boy and girl. And I'm sure each one of you can think of illustrations of what I'm trying to say. It is imperative that we open our mouths when we're speaking, that we articulate, project it.
We don't mumble into our words. We don't drop the end of the thing off.
I have heard brethren effectively deal with a phrase or a sentence, and when they get to the end, boy, do they get to the end. It's like going off the cliff. And you find yourself saying, what was that last word he said? Instead of concentrating on what he did say. Do you understand what I'm saying? You don't drop your voice at the end of a sentence. You don't clip off your words. You don't talk like a machine gun. You enunciate properly. You use proper grammar. You articulate in a measured way. Now, the only way you're going to do that, and I started to say you're going to do it. See, I caught myself because I'm thinking about it. The only way you're going to do it properly is to think about it, brethren. And when it's your responsibility to exhort, lecture, or preside, or teach a class, think about it in terms of your preparation. That doesn't mean that you're going to snap your fingers and become master of all that you survey overnight. But working at it will produce a very polished product. Remember the brother I mentioned in our first class who could hardly carry on an intelligible conversation, who today is a very, very good speaker? He did it by working at it. By working at it. Gestures. Gestures. We'll say a few words about gestures, and then we'll open the class to any kind of questions you want to throw at me. A gesture must be genuine. There are a number of kinds of gestures. There are forceful gestures, there are sentimental gestures, there's gestures of time and space, and they all add to effective translation to an audience. For example, Abraham lived some 2,000 years before the birth of Christ. We're somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 years since Christ was born. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's 2,000 years to 2,000 years. It's a 4,000-year period in between. Do you know I used that in Florida? I don't know whether you were there, Bob, or not. I doubt it. But I used that in Florida a few years ago, and there was a visitor there, and he came up to me after the lecture, and he says, you know, I never realized that such a time frame was involved. I know that what did it for that particular gentleman was that not practiced gesture. I practiced it tonight, of course, but not practiced gesture. It's one that came naturally in talking about that time span. When you talk about the size of something, it's huge. But when I'm sick and tired of you, I'll let you know it. And I mean, you can go on and on and on. But you don't manufacture them. They come from your intuitive emphasis. Remember that. I've got a problem, brethren, that I'm not ashamed to admit to you. Every once in a while, I'll get carried away, and we've got microphones in most of our halls. I'll get carried away, and I'll pound the lectern or the stand, and that's a mistake, because it's, woo! I mean, the mic shows it, the tape shows it, it's a mistake. I've even gotten to the point where I've caught myself like that. Too often I don't. It's a habit I've got to break. But it's a natural gesture on my part. If I get built up to a certain point, I'm apt to pound that stand, and that's wrong. Gesture all you want to, naturally, but stay away from that mic. Okay? There are really more than one way to emphasize the message you want to transmit. And let me finish my remarks by saying this. You must remember that when you are given the responsibility of exhorting, lecturing, or teaching a class, your prime responsibility is to share with your audience, small or large, in an understandable way, ideas and information that you have spent a great deal of time working on. And anything you can do to enhance your ability to make sure that their ability is enhanced to understand, you should do it. Now, we could have gone into a great more depth in terms of some of these elements than our four sessions permitted us to do. But that's the reason the Bible School Committee asked me to conduct this voluntary class, and I'm delighted with the number who have shown the motivation to want to listen to it. But you individuals can be your best teachers if you simply think about some of the things that I've mentioned. I have to think about them. Don't always do it to the satisfaction of myself. But you start thinking about them, you're going to be a better exhorter, a better speaker, and you can pass that on to those people to whom you're addressing, trying to influence. Now let's open the floor for questions. We had a number of them last night. There may not be any tonight. Yes, Brother Bob.
First thing, I thought all the people involved had forgotten that.
I just reminded them. That's what you call a flashback.
About pounding, suppose you step back and pound your fist into one hand.
Brother Stivers does it. It's almost a practiced gesture. He does it for effect, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's gotten to the point where I think that it's done with predetermined timing. And that loses its effectiveness. Nothing wrong with it. But if it's ever perceived by your audience to be manufactured, you've lost the impact. I don't know how you people have responded to that. First time or two, didn't bother me. But tonight, I got the impression it was a manufactured gesture, because he only did it one time. Yes?
At the outset, when you started talking about the use of words,
right,
you used dichotomy.
Yes.
And then you asked them how many of them.
Yes.
Knew what dichotomy meant. If in the course of a lecture you use the word dichotomy,
right,
and then you went on to explain it, which do you feel is a better approach to take? Not to use the word dichotomy, which is, you may be going over the heads of some of the audience, to go straight into what the word means and omit the word itself, to convey the same impression and understanding, or to use the word dichotomy, and if anybody wants to know, they'll ask you. Now, what makes me ask you this is, some years ago, I was in a mutual improvement class, and it used to be quite a friendly discussion as to whether you should what they call speak up to an audience, or whether you would go to the lowest level of confidence.
All right, I'll give you my opinion on that. You must, remember what I said two nights ago, you must try to read your audience. I would have absolutely no hesitation in using the word dichotomy in certain of the audiences that I address professionally. I would be very reluctant to use it in an exhortation in a Christadelphian meeting that involved some youngsters and some elderly people who may never have been exposed to that kind of situation. So I would avoid its use. In a public lecture, you'd have to think very carefully about how you would use it. There are occasions and circumstances where the use of words like that, an irrevocable, an erstwhile, and a lot of them, that might properly be used without any effort to define it. I was simply in my notes here trying to illustrate definitions. Have to be very careful. Very careful. That's why you must read your audience. And that's one of the advantages of extemporaneously speaking, speaking from notes. You can speak from notes this way or this way. You know the framework of what you want to deal with. But having read your audience, you can either express it in more juvenile terms or higher place terms, depending upon what you see. If there's a particular brother or sister in the audience that you know would have difficulty, don't do it. That person's not there, then you might do it. Those are the kind of things that you read when you speak extemporaneously. Yes, sir. Jim. Yes, I did. Visual aids. I alluded to it tonight, Jim. Visual aids are very effective, particularly in a public lecture structure. However, there's one danger. If we get to the point where the visual aids become the subject matter rather than what you have to say, we've overdone it. I would recommend that they never be used in an exhortive sense. A Sunday school class, yes, but not in an exhortation. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Comments on pronouncing of words and using a proper grammar.
Yes.
And the sounding of the endings of words. I think one of our problems is that very few of us are teachers and thereby used to using proper English and the right words all the time. Therefore, we sort of tend to speak in two languages. One language that we use commonly from day to day, talking to one another, and another language that we try to use when we give an exhortation or a lecture. And it seems to me if we tried to use the same language that we would use in giving an exhortation and a lecture all the time, all during our lives, in other words, not have two languages all, but just speak the proper English and the correct words all the time, that this would help us in our exhortation.
I couldn't disagree with that at all. In other words, learn to use the King's English and use the King's English is what you're saying. Yes.
What would you say would be the best method for speaking, brothers? Say he's dealing with an emotional subject and he himself gets overly emotional. What would you say would be the best way to totally avoid something like that? Take your time, compose yourself, or...
If you find yourself in that situation, obviously you have to take your time to compose yourself. However, a brother who has a responsibility, exhortive, funerals, weddings, must, going in, have his mindset that I'm going to be faced with a situation and simply overcome it. I've conducted probably 50, 60 funerals in my lifetime. One of those 50, 60, and I remember it well, was a very emotional situation. I've married a number of couples. One of them was a very emotional situation, and I knew that that possibility existed. I barely made it through, to be honest with you. But going in, my mindset was that I have got to steel myself and not give in to it. That's part of the responsibility when you have exhorted responsibilities. You've got to have the mindset going in to deal with whatever the subject matter or the occasion calls for. It's not easy, but if you go into it blind, then you're going to knuckle under. If you go into it with a mindset that I'm not going to give in, you're better off.
Do you recommend a situation like that, even if you operate on notes as a general rule to use a manuscript in a situation like that?
Not a bad idea at all. That's what I meant, Jim, when I said I quite often will put a manuscript paragraph when I'm giving a public lecture or a funeral, and certainly a wedding, although there are a number of extemporaneous comments in the process of those things. But that's where you've got to structure it a little bit differently, and that tends to help deal with the points you've raised, absolutely. Yes, sir.
Reading scriptural references such as concerning the emblems and the reading itself, do you recommend looking up 50% of the time or more to the audience, even though they may be having their heads down reading the same scripture?
No. Very good point. When a brother is doing the reading, let's say the daily reading in the morning or the reading that the exhorting brother has asked, it is not necessary for the reader to concentrate on the eye contact proposition, because 95 out of 100 people are going to have their eyes on their Bibles. In that situation, the answer is no. I'm talking about when you have that audience watching you. Big difference. Yes, Bob.
Wouldn't that also be very good practice?
It would be. Would be good practice. I'm not arguing about the practice. I read his question to mean, should you worry about eye contact in that situation? Good practice, yes, but not necessary because they're not looking at you. In fact, I have seen situations where the reading brother is totally unknown to the people. Totally unknown. He gets up and reads and sits down, and they don't know who he was because they have looked it up, they've been looking it up, and they follow it.
What's your thought on using the King James Version in a meeting as far as, I know in reading we use the King James, but others use other versions, with, and sometimes you lose some of the meaning.
Yes, you do. I have gotten, Brother Harry, and this is personal opinion, I've gotten to the point where I use my RSV most of the time. I will use it even in exhortive situations. But when I do, I let my audience know that I'm using the RSV, and when I read a citation from the RSV and I happen to know what the King James word or phrase is, I'll say, now in your own Bible it'll be this and this way or that way. I try to cover it by that bridge, but I've gotten to the point where I use the RSV because I prefer it. However, recognizing that the King James is the common, and I've got a King James, obviously, I will allude to that King James invariably. Yes, E. Well, you're talking about a practical ecclesial question. It has little or nothing to do with public speaking techniques, but I'll give you my opinion. I'll do it not on this tape. I think they should be uncovered, but in my own ecclesia, they're not. They are uncovered when the memorial service itself is underway, but not during the recitation. I like it, frankly, to have them uncovered before the recitation. But that's just my personal opinion. We're getting close to the bewitching hour. I'll take one or two more questions. Yes, Bob.
Your opinion, please, on the use of numbers. Like I've heard, particularly in lectures, brother will have a magazine, and he'll quote the date on it, and then he'll say that there were so many thousands of this stuff. People won't remember those numbers, and I find it to be, you know, almost totally useless to listen to the numbers he gives, and has really nothing to do with the subject. And you lose it.
If it has nothing to do with the subject, you shouldn't use it. If the
numbers in general, if these users are trying to emphasize the point by using numbers, it'd be because people will forget the numbers. And myself, I find it, I feel that they should not be used.
Well, Bob, it depends. It may be that a brother, particularly in a lecture situation, is trying to draw a mental picture of the size of something. It's unimportant, almost irrelevant, that the numbers be remembered if, in fact, the point of the size has been identified in the minds of the hearer. It depends. I'd have to look at the specific situation to give you an honest reaction. I can see where numbers would be used to identify the magnitude of something, but no intention that they be remembered. I wouldn't hesitate to use it for that purpose. Anything else? If not, all right, one more.
Scriptural references in your exhortation.
Yes. Always say where it's coming from. However, the question came up the other night, do we ask our audience to turn it up? And if you recall, I said, no, you don't, particularly in the exhortation situation. A brother or sister is going to turn that reference up by your identifying it. If it's a specific instance where you want to make sure a skeptic or a cynic in a lecture knows that you are saying exactly what that record says, then you might invite them to turn it up. Here again, it's a matter of reading your audience. But you should always identify where your citation is coming from. Always. Absolutely. Yes, Malcolm.
Not to belabor that point, but if I was to say Luke 21 and then prepare to read that, 90% of those listening would be thumbing through to find that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it better to give the verses and then say what it was at the end? Let's say it was Luke 21, verse 10 or whatever.
There are circumstances where that would be quite acceptable, Malcolm, if it's a matter of not wanting everybody to leaf through, particularly in the public lecture situation. In the exhortive situation, I wouldn't recommend that. I would recommend that just a slight pause. I mean a slight pause. I don't mean something 5 and 10 seconds long. When you've given a citation, just a slight pause, because most of the members are just as adept at turning those things up as we are. Which brings me to a point I didn't make that I must make. I'm sorry, I overlooked it. And it's a simple technique, brethren. It's very important. When you've got your Bible, now, if you're familiar enough with it that you turn your references up without any markers, which most of us eventually get to, that's fine. But if you have a half a dozen or more references that you're going to turn up, where do you put your markers?
On the bottom.
Absolutely on the bottom. Never on the top where they are seen. You never do this. You always do this. And a little technique, particularly for beginning brethren, is write the citation right on it. James 1:5. And you've got it sticking there. See, you've got your Bible open. Nobody's noticed. Well, brethren, I'm going to refer to the first chapter of James, verse 5. Well, you know people are going to start turning it up. But you reach down, you've got James 1:5, and there you are. But never at the top. Never put your hand. I'm sorry, Malcolm, but you sort of pushed my button on that one. I'm glad you did. Yes, Bob.
In connection with that, Bill, I've seen the young brother at our meeting. He has little tabs in like that. And it's very distracting that he takes them out, crinkles it up,
Bob,
puts it in his
pocket. Bob, amen. Absolutely. He's destroyed the whole proposition. Take them out and drop them on the floor if you have to, but don't take them out and crumple them up and put them in your pocket. Oh, no.
When you make a quotation, it's from one of those little books that's kind of hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
Write the page number by the quote.
That's fine. That's fine. Absolutely. Anything that will help you unobtrusively turn it up.
Yep.
Yes, Gil?
I sometimes do it. I've had done it. So mine is type the reference right in red or a different color, just so you know mm-hmm. you're coming to it, and it makes it that much easier. You're going to have to be tactful and allow time for people.
What that does is make you feel comfortable in terms of the way you transit into that, and that's fine. Anything that makes you comfortable. The whole principle from the speaking end is to do nothing, if you can avoid it, that's going to interfere with the reception on a smooth basis by your hearers. Anything that's going to distract them, stay away from it. Stay away from it. Well, I think the tape's run out. I've got to go back to Washington tonight, so we'll just cut it off now, and God willing, we'll work on all of this together. Thank you very much for your attendance.